Hello there. Today is Tuesday, July 31st. This is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, President Trump says he is willing to meet with the leader of Iran.
If we could work something out that's meaningful, not the waste of paper that the other deal was, I would certainly be willing to meet.
More than 4 years later, no answers as families of those lost on a vanished Malaysia Airlines flight express anguish. Deadly wildfires continue in the state of California. And a review of the latest Mission Impossible movie starring Tom Cruise. It's all on today's International Edition. U.S. President Donald Trump Monday made his most explicit statement yet that he's open to direct talks with Iran.
So I believe in meeting. I would certainly meet with Iran if they wanted to meet. I don't know that they're ready yet. They're having a hard time right now. But I ended the Iran deal. It was a ridiculous deal. I do believe that they will probably end up wanting to meet, and I'm ready to meet anytime they want to. And I don't do that from strength or from weakness. I think it's an appropriate thing to do.
Trump in the White House East Room during a joint news conference with Italian Prime Minister Giuseppe Conte was asked by a reporter if there would be preconditions for such a meeting.
No preconditions, no. They want to meet, I'll meet. Anytime they want. Anytime they want. It's good for the country, good for them, good for us, and good for the world.
Iran responded by saying the path to direct discussions with Washington would have to include the United States returning to the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, or JCPOA, as the nuclear deal between Iran and six world powers was formally called. An advisor to Prime Minister Hassan Rouhani tweeted, quote, "Respecting the Iranian nation's rights, reducing hostilities, and returning to the nuclear deal are steps that can be taken to pave the bumpy road of talks between Iran and America." VOA's Victor Beatty asks Shahram Akbarzadeh, professor of Middle East and Central Asian politics at Deakin University in Australia, what he thinks Trump's trying to do.
I think Trump is trying to copy what he has done with North Korea in relation to Iran. But there are certain problems, obvious problems, in that scenario, in the sense that the Iranian leadership has presented Trump as a bully and has presented the U.S. withdrawal from the nuclear deal as a betrayal of trust. So it's really hard for the Iranian leadership to now turn around and start a negotiation from scratch.
Can Iran be treated like North Korea and Russia, with which Mr. Trump has engaged in dialogue?
Well, Trump can try, but I think from the Iranian point of view, they have built a whole ideology and a whole persona for the state, the Islamic Republic, as a standing up to U.S. pressure. And it was very difficult for Rouhani to start the negotiation during Obama. And the only way he could actually proceed with the negotiation, nuclear negotiation deal, was because Obama was a much more moderate, mellow, and less antagonistic president. So the rhetoric coming out of the U.S. at that time were right for Rouhani to achieve the deal. With the rhetoric coming out of the United States now, which really borders on regime change, it makes it very difficult for Rouhani to start talking because it will look like capitulation to U.S. pressure.
As you know, just about a week ago, Secretary of State Pompeo launched a rhetorical assault on Iran's leaders, comparing them to the mafia and promising unspecified support for Iranians unhappy with their government.
Absolutely right. Mike Pompeo has been trying to drive a wedge between the Iranian people and the leadership. He has committed support to opposition voices. The Voice of America and other programs are to be broadcast to Iran to circumvent censorship. So there is a very clear message coming out of the U.S. administration on Iran, that the U.S. administration wants to encourage popular anger and popular protest against the regime. Mike Pompeo also talked about the protests in Iran and said they were an obvious demonstration of how the people are frustrated with the regime. So that is the angle they are driving, which is the angle of regime change.
Well, isn't there domestic concern about the economy and corruption? After all, the currency has dropped to below 100,000 to the dollar.
The currency has dropped due to the tensions, and of course there is widespread widespread disappointment and widespread dissatisfaction and dissent in Iran. So that is very true. But the point is that Mike Pompeo was trying to use that to encourage the regime change. And that's the point that Rouhani hasn't been lost to Rouhani, and that point hasn't been lost to the Iranian leadership. So they are very much aware that the U.S. preference would be regime change, which makes it a lot more difficult for them to set the table and negotiate with the U.S.
Would it be possible for Iran's moderates to seize this opportunity to talk, given the state of the economy?
The political cost of talking with the U.S. is much greater than anyone is prepared to risk. The political cost of talking to the U.S. is that they would look like they are capitulating, they are surrendering to U.S. pressure, and that's just too much for the reformists or moderates to contemplate.
So Mr. Trump's offer is a non-starter.
I don't expect that anyone in Iran would be responding positively to that invitation to meet at the moment.
That's Shaham Akbarzadeh, professor of Middle East and Central Asian politics at Deakin University in Australia. Here are some of the stories we are following at voanews.com. Excitement and optimism as Zimbabwe holds an historic election. Former Trump campaign chair is heading to trial on Tuesday. A lawsuit claims the U.S. travel ban waiver process is a fraud. And Mali says more than 700 polling stations are inoperable during the election. Find expanded coverage of these stories and more at voanews.com and on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. One of the world's great aviation mysteries remains unsolved after investigators said in a report released Monday that they do not know what happened to the Malaysia Airlines plane that disappeared 4 years ago. The head of the MH370 safety investigation team, Kok Soo Chan, told reporters in Kuala Lumpur that the team is unable to determine the real cause for the plane's disappearance without actually seeing the wreckage, which has yet to be found.
We are not of the opinion that it could have been an event committed by the pilot. But at the same time, we cannot deny the fact that there was an atom bag. We cannot deny the fact that, as we have analyzed, the systems were manually turned off with intent or otherwise. So we feel that there's also one possibility that could account for all this. We are not ruling out any possibility.
Chan also floated the possibility of a third party possibly playing a role in the incident. VOA Asia's Ira Melman spoke with Mary Schiavo about that. She's the former Inspector General of the U.S. Department of Transportation and now a private aviation attorney.
Well, any investigation, be it an air crash investigation or a criminal investigation, is a process of ruling things out. And so what this report did is went through many scenarios, most of which they could rule out. And so they said the one thing they couldn't rule out is that it was a third party. Presumably it would have to have been, obviously, a stowaway, because they did go through the passenger list. And if every passenger was who that passenger said that person was, and they did do a background check on those people, they looked at everybody on the plane, and no one could fly the plane except the pilot and co-pilots who they ruled out. So what they're saying is this is one thing they could not rule out.
Any possibility that it could have been a cyber crime?
Well, not really. They went to extensive detail about the fact that Boeing does have a patent for a remotely controlled aircraft, but that's all that they have. They have the patent, and that's not been installed on any civilian aircraft around the world to remotely control it. In other words, turn a 777 into a drone. And they said that's impossible. So if it was some kind of a cyber crime, it would not have been a remote control cyber crime. And, of course, that would rule it out because this report says that at certain points in this flight, there were hands on the controls. Someone in the cockpit moved the controls of the plane.
So therefore, manually rather than autopilot. And that, of course, initially opened up the possibility of a suicide. But you don't think that's the case, do you?
Oh, I don't think that's the case at all. And I think the report does a good job of showing that it is not pilot suicide. And I've worked on other cases that were pilot suicides, such as Egypt Air, German Wings. And this did not have any of the hallmarks of it. And the report went to great lengths to rule out financial problems, mental problems, and conclusively ruled out the rumor that has haunted this case from the beginning, that the pilot in command had flown this route on his home computer and had, quote, practiced this route. This report said absolutely not. He didn't do that.
Well, this case is almost all haunted. What happened to the plane? What do you think went on?
Well, I've worked similar crashes with hypoxia, where there's a malfunction on the plane and the pilots start to lose their cognitive judgment, their ability to make good sense determinations because they are oxygen starved. Now, there was a repair to this plane on some oxygen lines, but it was repaired, so you can't say it was that. But the hallmarks of turning back, of a garbled transmission, of making some decisions but not being able to make them all, to me, that still says a mechanical and some side, a sort of hypoxia event with the pilots, and it is fits with that because while there were hands-on controls at certain parts of the flight, meaning on the turn back and the crossover Malaysia, in the ending moments of the flight, there were not hands on the control because, how do we know that? Because the flaperon was stowed. If you were trying to make a controlled landing on water, that would have been not in the stowed condition. So by the time this flight was over, no one in the cockpit was alive or flying the plane.
Why do you think the plane has not been found? Is it solely a situation of geography?
No, and the report went to great lengths on that. And I was surprised by the Malaysia government citing so many faults with air traffic controllers and people whose jobs, it was their job to watch the radar. And this report is highly critical of those people, not just Malaysia personnel either. They failed to run a tight ship for the control of the aircraft when certain reportings had to be done. And even when the aircraft did not report in on time, they did not make a call to or coordinate with the military to start the search. So my read of this report is that the failure to find this plane may rest with the Malaysia government itself, a little bit with the Ho Chi Minh control, but mostly with the Malaysia government and the failure to coordinate with the military so the plane could be tracked and found. I was surprised they were that critical of their own government.
Well, meanwhile, the lack of resolution after all this time is not sitting well with families of the victims. Danica Weeks, whose husband Paul was on board Malaysia Airlines Flight 370, says this latest report doesn't shed any light on what happened.
It's just unacceptable. It's ludicrous that you can lose a Boeing 777 and so long on, we still have no idea where they are or what happened. And look, Malaysians are responsible for this plane and we hope that they were going to be the ones to tell us and give us information. And again, we've been let down.
The plane was carrying 239 people on the flight from Kuala Lumpur to Beijing. Firefighters battling a deadly blaze in Northern California struck a hopeful note on Monday after days of trying to contain the fire that's killed at least six people and destroyed more than 700 homes and businesses. Two children and two firefighters are among those who lost their lives. Woody Smack says this is the fourth firefighter to die in the line of duty this year in California.
Each one is a tragic loss. Each one affects a family and an extended family and friends and the firefighting community and the public service community.
Firefighter John Nicky tells KNBC-TV fighting this car fire is a challenge.
It's hard to corral this thing. It's to the point where you're going to have to back off and find a safer place to move in.
The car fire was ignited by a vehicle a week ago, about 16 kilometers west of Reading, a city about 92,000 people, which is about 370 kilometers northeast of San Francisco. International Edition's Sarah Williams spoke with VOA's West Coast Bureau Chief Mike O'Sullivan about the devastation.
It sounds as if it is getting worse. It's only 5% contained, and we know that six people have died in the fires, including a 70-year-old woman and her two great-grandchildren, two firefighters as well, and another unidentified body was found on Sunday. So firefighters, when these things strike a rural area like this, and this is about 260 kilometers north of Sacramento, a small community of about 90,000 with a lot of outlying people in the rolling wooded hills outside the city of Redding. And it seems to be basically burning out of control. And what firefighters typically do is protect the more populated areas and try to create fire breaks around the perimeters where the fire is slowing down. But the difficulty now is they say the fire has created its own weather patterns. There's so much heat being generated, and it's the humidity is very low, and the temperatures are very high. So it's a real battle for them.
The case involving the woman and her two great-grandchildren was especially tragic. What's known about what happened there?
Not a lot. We know that the family was speaking to the great-grandmother and the two kids as I believe the great-grandfather was driving back, and they lost contact, and apparently the area was engulfed in flames. So that's about all we know at this point. It's a tragic thing, but when fires are this bad and they're going through residential communities, those outlying communities up in the mountains, if people are still, if they haven't evacuated, it's very risky.
Yeah, and I suppose that's absolutely key when an evacuation order is in effect. People need to move.
That's right. And, you know, they sometimes call these evacuations mandatory, but people don't always respond, or they don't respond quickly enough, and there are many reasons for that. Some older people are just not able to get organized, you know, quickly enough. People are sometimes worried about their animals. A lot of people in rustic areas have dogs and cats, horses, and they don't want to leave the animals. So it's a real problem for authorities to try to clear those areas out. And these fires move so quickly that people don't always recognize the danger. They may see smoke, they may even see flames in the far distance, but they don't realize how quickly the flames can sweep through their area.
Well, now, I also believe state officials, Governor Jerry Brown, as well as the federal government, have declared a disaster area.
That's right. And they have to do this to free up the federal funds and the state funds that are needed to cope with the disaster and then cope later on with the rebuilding. But this is an annual thing for us that, you know, fires, it's very dry here all summer. So July, August, September, we get little or no rain. The temperatures are hot, very low humidity, and we've been through about 5 years of drought. We're out of the drought now. It was about 2012 to 2017, but the fire conditions are still very bad in some of these rustic mountain tree-covered areas, and what we typically see every year, you know, even during good years, is a lot of fires in these areas, and in a bad year, as we've had recently, we've had many bad years, the fires, we get large fires that just burn out of control. Sometimes they burn until the rains come in the fall, but we're hoping this one can be contained at some point before that.
That's VOA's California correspondent Mike O'Sullivan. You're listening to International Edition on VOA.
Join your host, Larry London, for Border Crossings, VOA's Worldwide Music Request Hour, every weekday at 1500 Universal. Tune in to hear your favorite songs and artists, win prizes and giveaways, and get the latest scoop from exclusive celebrity interviews. Send in requests to our Facebook, Twitter, or Instagram, or call 202-618-2077 to have your favorite music played for the entire world. Don't miss Border Crossings every weekday at 1500 Universal.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of VOA's Press Conference USA. This week, a look back at the 2018 FIFA World Cup. Les Bleus, Croatia, and other highlights and surprises, as well as the politics, with Sunny Young, host of VOA's Sunny Side of Sports, and João Santarita of VOA's Portuguese to Africa service. The World Cup in Review, that's Press Conference USA, this Saturday and Sunday on The Voice of America.
VOA's International Edition continues. Well, those who have been lucky enough to enjoy the Gregorian chants and complex Renaissance melodies of the Pope's choir say it's like hearing the angels sing. The choir sings at all the main papal events and travels around the globe to perform. Officials say the choir delivers a message of peace to people of all faiths. VOA's Sabina Castelfranco reports from Rome.
This is the oldest active choir in the world. The Sistine Chapel Choir is the Pope's personal one, formed in 1471. The best place to hear it is inside the Vatican Sistine Chapel. This is the choir's home, a place where the acoustics are magnificent and the frescoes by Renaissance master Michelangelo are an inspiration. Michelangelo Nardella is the choir's administrator.
We are the Pope's only choir. It has been so for centuries. For 16 centuries, we have traces of choir singers close to the Pope.
The acclaimed choir performs worldwide for people of all faiths, Nardella says, carrying a message of peace.
Let us not forget that our concerts are always evangelical missions. We carry the church's message and do not simply perform in an artistic event.
The Sistine Chapel Choir is comprised of 20 highly accomplished professional singers chosen from around the world. The younger section, the Pueri Cantores, includes 35 boys between 9 and 13 years old, children carefully selected after rigorous auditions. That group of boys, or white voices, attend a special school in Rome where they follow their regular schooling and practice daily singing.
These years of study allows them to become young professionals who sing in the Pope's celebrations and in concerts in Italy and in the world.
The moment their voice changes, their time on the choir is up, says the choir maestro Massimo Palombella. But adds Palombella, for all members of the choir, meeting and performing for the Pope is unforgettable, and delivering a message of peace to the world is the honor of a lifetime. Sabina Castelfranco for VOA News, Rome.
Which way, Betty? Mission Impossible Fallout, firing on all cylinders at the box office this weekend, and not only it came out on the top of the charts, but also scored a franchise-best opening. The sixth film in the series grossed more than $61 million in its first weekend in theaters, which is also one of star Tom Cruise's best launches. Mission Impossible Fallout follows operative Ethan Hunt, the daredevil spy on a mission impossible to save the world. And joining us now to talk more about the movie, Vegas film critic Jeffrey K. Howard. Jeff, it's clearly doing phenomenally well. What did you think of the film?
Well, you know, it's the sixth in the series, and I just want to first by saying Tom Cruise is a god.
Okay. Why? Because he did his own stunts?
The stunts, absolutely. This man, you know, I don't know how he tops himself every movie, but, you know, he's really going to have a tough time topping this one. Briefly, the movie's about he had to choose between getting his plutonium devices or saving one of his team members in the beginning of the film. He saves one of his team members. So the bad guys get the plutonium, and they want to put it on the black market so a terrorist could make a nuclear weapon, you know? It's going to go to the highest bidder. So the rest of the movie, he is tracking down these plutonium devices. That's all you need to know. That is the thin thread in this movie, because we have so many incredible action sequences in this film, things that have never been done before, especially from Mr. 55-plus-year-old Cruise doing these incredible stunts. For example, he does what they call a halo jump in the movie, and halo is high altitude, low opening, meaning when you see him jump out of the back of that airplane at 25,000 feet, that is Tom Cruise going out the window.
Oh, my goodness.
I mean, the back of the plane with the camera guy below him doing this incredible aerial stunt that he trained a year for to do that.
Wow.
When you see him driving through the streets of Paris on a motorcycle, it is him. When you see him driving through the streets of London in the car chases, it is him. And here's the most incredible one. When you see him flying these helicopters at the end doing these dog chases, he spent a year and a half learning how to fly a helicopter. I am not kidding. So the adrenaline in this movie is off the hook, is off the chart. And not only that, he's got scenes where he's climbing a rope of a helicopter, and that's really him. It is really him doing it. And he's so dedicated. There's a scene where he's doing, of course, his classic running. He runs in every movie. He was running through the streets of London, and he jumped from one rooftop to another, and he missed it. And you see it in the movie where he broke his ankle and broke his ribs, and he gets up and limps away. It was kept in the film. He was down for 8 months. But then he came back, and they started all over again. You know, so the man is dedicated to his fans. He's dedicated to telling exciting stories. I'm telling you, Lori, I have never seen anything like this. One of the most incredible action films I've ever seen. And
whoa.
The team is back. You got Ving Rhames. You got Simon Pegg. The great Alec Baldwin is the leader of the IMF. You know, so this is a movie everyone's going to be talking about. It's already made a fortune. And here's the one thing I really love about Tom Cruise. He has been promoting this film like crazy. The Tokyo premiere, the London premiere, the Paris premiere, the Washington, D.C. premiere, where you are, was just a few days ago. So this man has been on every talk show. He signs autographs. He stays for hours on these red carpet meeting his fans and talking to the press. This is one of the most exciting moments of this summer. And I'm telling people, go see it, which I don't have to because they will anyway, but see it in IMAX on the big screen.
That was Jeffrey K. Howard. You can find his full video reviews at VegasFilmCritic.com. You've been listening to International Edition. That does it for today's show, but you can find us anytime at VOAnews.com. We thank you for joining us, and thanks to our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, John Ellison. I'm Lori London in Washington. Have a great day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The recent Ministerial to Advance Religious Freedom, hosted by the United States in Washington, discussed ways to combat religious persecution and ensure greater respect for religious freedom. Among the topics of discussion was Iran. In an interview, U.S. Ambassador for International Religious Freedom Sam Brownback said, "Iran has been one of the worst countries in the world on religious persecution."
If you're anything but a Shia Muslim in that country, you do not have religious freedom. If you're a Sunni, if you're a Baha'i, if you're a Christian, if you're a Jew, if you're a Zoroastrian, any of those, you don't have religious freedom.
Secretary of State Mike Pompeo described an example of religious persecution in Iran, this time of a Sufi, during his recent speech at the Reagan Presidential Library in California.
Last month, a simple man, a bus driver, a father of two children, and a member of the Iranian Gobadi Sufi Dervish community was convicted and sentenced to death. His sentence came on questionable grounds, following violent clashes between security forces and the dervishes. He was reportedly denied access to a lawyer before and during his grossly unfair trial. Sadly, on June 18th, the regime hanged Mr. Salas in prison.
Radio Farda reports that verdicts have now been issued against 258 Iranian dervishes charged with national security crimes for participating in the February protests. The International Federation of Human Rights Societies has described the trial of the dervishes as a mockery of justice and a blatant violation of international principles and standards. Sentences include exile, lashings, and long prison terms. On the opening day of the ministerial, U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo wrote that the Trump administration is passionate about promoting and defending international religious freedom, not just in Iran, but everywhere. But the challenge, he added, is too big for any one nation. Others, Secretary Pompeo said, must join us as we fight for the persecuted, speak out for the voiceless, and work together to pave the way for greater religious freedom around the world.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.